University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, brings speakers and performers to the campus throughout the semester to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum features Warren K. Erbaum, District Judge for the District of Nebraska, with his presentation, The Unfolding Constitution. Erbaum graduated from Nebraska Wesleyan with highest distinction in 1950 and attended the University of Michigan Law School, graduating in 1953. He began his professional career as a trial lawyer in 1953 and worked in that area until he became a district judge in 1970. Erbaum served as Chief Justice over the Nebraska District Court from 1972 to 1986. In 1962, Erbaum was recognized by Nebraska Wesleyan and received a Young Alumni Service Award from the university. He chaired the university's Board of Governors from 1975 to 1988, also serving as chairman of various committees. Wesleyan presented Erbaum with an honorary Doctor of Laws degree in 1984.
Today is September 30, 1888. That means that Grover Cleveland is in his last year of his first term of office as President of the United States. Victoria is in her 51st year as Queen of England. John L. Sullivan is heavyweight champion of the world. The Eiffel Tower is being built. The quote of the year is by Clay Allison, who is United States Marshal for the territory of New Mexico. He says, "I never killed nary a man what didn't need it." It's a presidential election year. Grover Cleveland has been renominated by the Democrats, Benjamin Harrison by the Republicans. As it will turn out, Cleveland will get the larger of the vote popularly. He'll have a majority of the popular votes, but will lose in the Electoral College. Also running for president is Belva Lockwood. She ran in 1884, lost, and will run again this year. One of the Lincoln newspapers, the Weekly State Journal, has been supporting her for president. But last month, issued this article in its paper. "We regret to say that we must now not support Belva Lockwood in her search for the presidency. It has now been conclusively proven that she does not wear a bustle. While we are not strong advocates of the bustle, we can no longer withstand the slings and arrows of outraged females who will not support a newspaper who does not support the concept of this most useful article. Therefore, she will have to carry on without us unless she can find someone else to support her in her presidency." The attitude in Nebraska is one of ebullience. The rains are here, the crops are good. Things are moving very well. People are rushing into Nebraska. We have 1 million people here already. More people have moved into this state in the last decade than at any other time ever. More than that, there are now more towns have been put up, more houses, more post offices, more churches, more everything in this past decade than in any other decade in Nebraska history, and that will prove to be true for 100 years. This is the time of expansion for Nebraska. Lincoln does well. Nebraska Wesleyan University opens its doors to its new students this month. Cotner College is just getting off the ground this year. The University of Nebraska is in good shape, except for a rift within the administration and the faculty over two issues. One has to do with whether the church will have a substantial role in the governance of the University of Nebraska, and secondly, whether the education will retain its traditional, classical form, or move into professional training. The faculty is at odds with each other, and the administration is as well. A group of young faculty members from Harvard and other Eastern colleges have been employed here, but some are leaving now because of this conflict. Indeed, in May of this year, Chancellor Manette resigned, probably because of that split that he had not been able to cure, and has returned to the East to teach, I think, Greek at Brown University. A trial has just been finished here in Lincoln over whether a minister in the Negro church here in Lincoln should receive a salary. The congregation wants not to pay him. He claims that he was promised pay. The newspaper report of that trial is an interesting one. It refers to the people there as the dusky sons of Ethiopia. And the heading on the column, large letters, is Coons in Court. We've had two lynchings in Nebraska so far this year. One in Red Cloud, one in Pawnee City. The economy, though good, is at a cutting edge, I think. Two problems. One is that though production is good, prices are low. 83 cents for a bushel of wheat, 22 for a bushel of corn. It costs as much to send a bushel of wheat to market as another bushel will bring. And the farmers around here think that that's largely because the railroads have a monopoly. They charge anything they want to charge. The ICC, which is the first federal full-time regulatory agency, has just been in place for less than a year, designed in part to control prices of railroads. But I have to say the farmers around here don't have much confidence in the government in that or in most any other respect, and have chosen to take it on themselves to organize the Farmers Alliance, 250 chapters here in Nebraska alone, partially aimed at controlling the prices charged by the railroads. I think this suggests to you that the nature of our society today in 1888 is about this. It's brash, robust, supremely confident, suspicious, and I'll do it myself. That's the nature of the beast. Now I want you to roll your minds back for 100 years. Roll back to 1788, September 30, 1788. Where were we 100 years ago? Well, to understand 1788, you have to understand the year that preceded 1788, namely 1787. In 1787, it was concluded that the 13 states that now were only a dozen years out of the Revolutionary War no longer understood what unity meant. They were splintered, self-seeking, going off in all directions. There was no common system of money, no system of common system of taxation. There was nothing to control trade as between the states. They were all moving in different directions. The central government, the national government, had virtually no power, so that when a group of farmers undertook a kind of rebellion against the government because of poor economic conditions, the federal government was in not a position to do anything to control it. It had to be left to one or more of the states to control. It was concluded, therefore, that what they ought to do is gather together representatives of the states to see if they could tighten up the Articles of Confederation to give some centrality to the power distribution of the United States. So representatives of 12 of those states got together and met for four hot, sweaty, fly-infected months in the State House in Philadelphia. And by September 17th of 1787, they had before them a document of 4,440 words. which they declared would be distributed first to the Congress and then to the states to see whether they could be adopted. And if 9 of the states out of 13 adopted those articles, they would become the Constitution of the United States, the supreme law of the land. In 9 months, by June of 1788, 9 of the states had ratified that Constitution. It wasn't easy. Debates took place in every ratifying convention over many different issues. Among them were the distribution of power. Did the executive have too much power? Did the Congress have too little power? Did the judiciary have enough power or too much? What about the issue of slavery? An issue which had divided the country in many ways already was now coming to a head, it was believed, and ought to be resolved by some. But the proposed Constitution said nothing about slavery except to leave it in place and declare that nothing would happen respecting it as to the national government for at least 20 years. And that if somebody in bondage were found in one state who belonged in the other state, he would be transported back to the other state. So that slavery was rigidified, if nothing else, by the Constitution of the United States. And that was a supreme cause of debate amongst the people who were deciding whether to adopt this as a Constitution of the United States. Another issue was that the rights of the people were not specified in large measure, or few of them were, but not very many of them. There was no Bill of Rights. And many of the people thought there ought to be a Bill of Rights. And until there was put in place a Bill of Rights, there would not be anything except an invitation to tyranny. That was the argument. Well, 9 of the states did approve it by June of 1787. By September 30 of 1788, 2 more states had approved it. That left only North Carolina and Rhode Island, who had not approved it. And they didn't approve it for another year and 2. One took a year, another took 2 years to approve it. By the time Rhode Island approved it, who had not thought enough of the whole business to even send delegates to the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, because they were such a small state and considered that they would be gobbled up no matter what they did. By the time Rhode Island approved the Constitution by a vote of, I believe, 34 to 32, a president had been elected. Congress had been elected and put in place. The federal judiciary had been put in place. And a Bill of Rights had been suggested by James Madison in Congress, had been approved by Congress and circulated to the states for ratification. But that was only took place by December 15 of 1791. Move back now to today, that is September 30, 100 years ago, 1788. By then, 11 of the states had approved it, and today, September 30 of 1788, the first state, Pennsylvania, elected its senators to be in the new Senate of the United States. Well, now, we've had this Constitution around us with the Bill of Rights for 100 years. What has it meant to us? What has the Constitution of the United States meant in the first 100 years of its life? I think it's fair to say that it has been a skeleton around which a nation could grow. The primary effort for 100 years has been to try to unify what was disunified earlier, to see if we could declare that we indeed were a nation. It has not been easy. 23 years ago, we ended a civil war over that issue. We could not declare ourselves a nation until that devastation occurred, apparently. 500,000 lives tell the story. And since that time, we have undertaken the job of trying to decide what kind of a people we are. We've done some more amending of the Constitution to try to broaden the voting rights of people. We have passed the 13th Amendment to eliminate the scourge of slavery. And we have passed the 14th Amendment, which, among other things, declared two major principles. No state. I underline the word state. Let me explain why. The Constitution of the United States and its Bill of Rights virtually did nothing at all with respect to protecting the people from the states. The Bill of Rights was aimed at the protection of the people from the national government. So the First Amendment starts off, Congress shall make no law. And that was the theme running throughout those First Amendments to the Constitution. Now here comes the 14th Amendment saying, no state shall deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. Two magnificent ideas. A state will not take away life, liberty, or property without due process of law. It shall not deny to any person the equal protection of the laws. Now, we don't know in 1888 what that either of them means. Not really. We don't know what they mean. We can guess, but we don't really know. I think it's fair to say that in 1888, today, about what we can say is that the 14th Amendment, insofar as the due process of law clause is concerned, means about this. A person has a right to hold the property which comes to that person as a result of his or her labor. I said her. I withdraw that. His labor. You see, we are steeped at this moment in our history in the idea that freedom to work, to bargain, to contract, to do business, is at the bottom of our destiny. If we can do that, we can grow and emerge as a powerful nation and society. The result is that the 14th Amendment is being interpreted as being an indication that government cannot interfere with that liberty to contract, to make deals, to do business, to work. My prediction is that it won't be very long until the Supreme Court of the United States says that if a state seeks to interfere with a contract between an employer and a laborer by, for example, saying that nobody can hire somebody to work for more than 60 hours a week, that will be held to be contrary to the 14th Amendment of the Constitution of the United States. There is a liberty interest, a property interest, perhaps, in the freedom to contract. And an employer and employee can contract as they choose and cannot be interfered with by the state except in the most extraordinary circumstances. Well, what about equal protection of the laws? Today, in 1888, our society is fairly segregated. Minorities are not highly thought of and essentially keep their place. I'll not be surprised if the Supreme Court of the United States shortly declares that if a state requires that blacks and whites ride in separate cars on a railroad, that that's approved, that that's proper, that that is constitutional. It is not a violation of the Constitution of the United States to require a separation of the races. If that's true, if that turns out to be true, I suppose it can mean that we can build upon a legal basis a rigid system of massive segregation. Well, now, let's go back to the due process of law clause a little bit. What does it mean to say that a state cannot take from us life, liberty, or property without due process of law? I've said that I think I know what it means as of 1888. What can it mean? Look forward 100 years now. Suppose by 1988 we're asking the question, what does the 14th Amendment mean now that we've lived with it for over 100 years? Well, let your imaginations explode. What could it mean? What is life, liberty, property? Well, the first question is, what's life? I suppose we all think we know what life is. What about an unborn child? Is that life? I suppose we'll face that. What is liberty? Liberty to do what? The state won't take away from us without some kind of due process, whatever that means. Liberty. What liberty? Somebody has to figure out what is meant by liberty. And I suppose under the Constitution that's assigned in the ultimate end to the courts. Imagine, if you can, that someone would conclude that liberty in the 14th Amendment means the liberties that are set out in the first 8 amendments of the Constitution of the United States. Religion, speech, the right to assemble, the right to petition the government, the right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures, the right to be represented in court by a lawyer, the right to certain processes of protection in criminal matters when you're charged, the right not to suffer unusual, cruel punishment for crimes. If that were true, it would mean that a state could not take those things away, or any one of them, without due process of law, whatever that means. I suppose due process could mean that a certain procedure has to be gone through that's fair before the state can take it away. And I suppose it could mean that there has to be a sensible basis for it before it can be taken away by a state. Now, let me give you an illustration. I suppose it could be that one day, even though today in 1888 we don't have any horseless carriages, it could be that one day there will be such a thing. We will have things that people may call automobiles. And it could be that a state will take on the idea that in order to drive an automobile, you have to be licensed. And it may say, in order for us to identify people correctly, we better have their photograph on a license. Now suppose a person says, I don't like it. I don't like it. I read in my Bible that there should not be any graven image, nor any likeness of anything in the heavens above or in the earth beneath. And a photograph of me is a likeness of something under the heavens. And if you tell me, state, that I have to have a photograph of me on my person, it is causing me to give up my religious freedom in order to get a benefit from the state. And I think she would say that's what the First Amendment is about. Congress, a state, shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. And it won't interfere with the free exercise of religion. This interferes with my free exercise of religion. Well, is that what it means? Don't be amazed if a federal judge somewhere were to say, that's right, that's right. That's what it means. All right. Suppose in the next 100 years, a state, any state, would say, children in our schools in this state must be led in prayer every day by a teacher, and this is the prayer. And suppose somebody says, the First Amendment of the Constitution, now a part of the 14th Amendment, talks about establishment of religion. That there won't be an establishment of religion, that is, an establishing, an approval, a placing of the hand of approval of the state on religion. And I think if my children have to pray in school, or have to be subjected to an environment where they are told that they ought to be praying, that's an establishment of religion. That's a placing of the hand of approval of the state on religion, and most particularly on a particular religious idea. And this person may say, that's a violation of my constitutional right. Oh, don't be amazed if the Supreme Court of the United States might say, that's true. That's true. A state can neither require a child to pray in school nor forbid a child to pray in school. The Supreme Court may say that. Well, that won't end the problems. There are 1,000 issues like that that are all around us. What is religion? What is religion? Is creationism religion? Is secular humanism religion? Maybe in the next 100 years we'll have to decide that. We'll have to try to figure out what religion is. And sometimes wrap your mind around that one and see what you can figure out as to what religion is that the government is supposed to have its hand out of. Or suppose in 100 years we're confronted with a spate of problems having to do with the use of drugs. Some new drug comes along, or an old drug. It doesn't make any difference. That's everywhere. And so government says what we ought to have in order to control this menace is testing, in order to be able to find out where drugs are being used and how much it's affecting the working place. And let's find out. So on a basis of being periodical, unannounced, let's have testing. Does the Constitution allow it when it says that we shall not be subject to unreasonable searches and seizures? Is it an unreasonable search of a person's body to test that person for drugs by taking something from the body in order to test that something to see? Well, we'll have to find out, I suppose. I suppose that after experimenting for 100 years and more with capital punishment, we decide that the experience indicates that the people we're putting to death as a result of crimes are the poor and the ignorant and the members of minority races and the young. A, is that a denial of equal protection? B, can the government do that without a process that assures objectivity in deciding whether a person ought to be put to death. Well, don't be amazed if the issue is raised in the next 100 years. And the argument will be made that until you can objectify the factors to make sure that it isn't just people who are ignorant or poor or young or a minority who are put to death, we'll not put people to death. That'll be the argument that ought to be made, will be made, I submit to you. The outcome, I haven't the vaguest idea, but he will wrestle with it in the next 100 years. Okay, what about equal protection of the laws? We've said in 1868 in the 14th Amendment, there has to be equal protection of the laws. How equal is equal? Who is supposed to be equal to whom? In 1888, what we know is that we have a segregated society, as I already indicated to you, and as you well know. Suppose one day somebody reads the 14th Amendment and says, it says any person. Well, are blacks persons? Are American Indians persons? It may be that in the next 100 years, someone will say, when we are required by the Constitution not to deprive any person of the equal protection of the laws, it means that we cannot require black people to drink from different drinking fountains from the whites, or sit in different railroad cars, or eat at different counters in the restaurant, or go to separate schools, or anything else. What about women? What about women? Now in 1888, no woman can vote, I think, anywhere in the country. A married woman can't own property, she can't make a contract, she can't get a professional education, she can't have custody of her own children, she can't keep her own money or control her own property, even if she earned it herself. And do you suppose in the next 100 years, someone will read the 14th Amendment and say, person means woman, too? Well, you can speculate as well as I. You can speculate as well as I as to what the Constitution of the United States will mean to us in 100 years. We'll not be over either the trouble, I suppose, of trying to figure out the proper distribution of power. The Constitution of the United States assumes that people who are in positions of power in government will exercise the natural passions that they have. And that natural passion will guard us all from the excesses of them all. Here's what I mean. Virtually any important decision that's to be made by the federal government has to receive the approval of two different branches of government. If the President of the United States wants to appoint somebody to the Supreme Court of the United States, that President has to have the approval of the Senate of the United States, or there will be no appointment. It's just that flat in the Constitution of the United States. If Congress wants to borrow money in order to operate the business of government, it has to have the approval of the President of the United States in order to do so, unless it overrides a veto by 2/3 of its members. You see, the idea is that when a person is put in place of power, that person will have a natural desire to hold on to that power, either because of a lust for power or for a call to duty, whatever you call it. It still will be a desire to hold on to the power that's given. And so, when it designates that a particular person within government or a branch of the government is to have a certain duty or an obligation or limitation of power, the chances are that when another branch is given some of that power, the other branch will exercise all of it and thus limit the other branch. So that if two branches are involved, they will be at constant tension. That's the idea. And that creative constant tension, it is believed, is what will help protect us from excesses, one of the other. The Constitution, therefore, will ask, or the people will ask of the Constitution, I submit to you in the next 100 years, not only whether a president can appoint somebody to the Supreme Court of the United States that the Senate doesn't want, but other magnificent questions of distribution of power, like, can there be permitted by the President of the United States the sending of weapons to a country when the Congress says no? Can the Congress have a war without declaring so? That is to say, can it fund a war without declaring war, which the Constitution puts on the Congress has a duty, that is, to declare war? Well, a dozen other kinds of questions like that of distribution of power that we'll have to wrestle with in the next 100 years, and they won't be through then, I submit. The Constitution was built on 5 basic ideas. Number 1, the power to govern resides in the people as a whole. The power to govern resides in the people as a whole. You see, for the first time ever, with the possible exception of the Mayflower Compact, a group of people got together in 1787 and said, this is the kind of government we want, based upon reason and desire, and not at the behest of some benevolent dictator or a king or a conquering hero. Number 2, the people will give from time to time to some of its representatives a part of that power with duties to match. 3rd, those people who are in power will not be perfect, either in wisdom or in motive, and thus they have to be watched and checked and changed from time to time. 4, the Constitution itself is not perfect, and it will have to be changed from time to time. And 5, the people are not perfect, and we have to grow from time to time. It's a magnificent document, the Constitution of the United States. It unfolds with time. It deals with the most passionate, sensitive issues we know. And those issues don't go away. 100 years haven't seen them go away. 100 won't see them go away. And 100 after that, and 100 after that, we'll see those issues still there. What the Constitution does is offer us an opportunity to reconsider all the time those issues and move and develop and grow so that the collective wisdom of experience can be built into the system. Has it worked? I think so, when we have made it work. Will it work? I think it will, if we make it work. Thank you.
Today, University Forum has presented Warren K. Erbaum, District Judge from the District of Nebraska. He spoke on the unfolding Constitution. This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is a private undergraduate liberal arts college located in Lincoln, Nebraska. Approximately 1,300 students are enrolled in more than 40 major programs.